So let's talk about pride today, because all three of these chapters have a lot to do with, well, actually pride and humility. When you read chapter 4, 5, and 6 together, there's this pattern that God has woven through human history. Three men, three stories, three outcomes, all tied to one truth. And this, if you look at verse 17 in Daniel 4, it says, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men." That's going to be our theme throughout all three chapters. Every person, every nation, every leader will either humble themselves under God's hand, or they're going to be humbled by God's hand. I'm always amazed that as believers, we don't recognize that principle all the time. This morning, we see the three circumstances that we as believers, we experience all these things in our lifetime. We have times where pride gets the best of us. Wouldn't you agree with that? Pride can get the best of us. Things are prospering. You have a full wind in your sail, and it begins to cloud your perception. We've become good at our jobs. We become talented. We have these gifts, and we get ahead in life, and soon we begin to take the credit for that success. You know, we see in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar makes the boast in verse 20 or 29, if you look at that. And remember, now we're going through this in a summary, so I'm not going to be reading everything, I'm trying to squish together the three chapters. But look at verse 29. He says, "At the end of 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon, and the king spoke, saying, 'Is this not great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power for the honor of my majesty?'" A lot of my's in there, a lot of I's in there. So he takes credit for the success, and then he takes the glory to himself. Isaiah 42 says, "I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another." The Lord deserves all the credit, all the glory. It's not to be shared with human people, with proud people. Fortunately, Nebuchadnezzar, he comes to his senses. In chapter 5, you have a different story. His grandson, now it'll say in chapter 5, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. They didn't have a word for grandfather, but it is his grandson that we'll be talking about in chapter 5. His grandson makes the same mistake, but it cost him, and his sins are final. They're fatal in judgment from God. Nebuchadnezzar, we're going to find out, turns it around. He humbles himself before the Lord. Our third example is Daniel in chapter 6 himself. His humility is his protection. It's really important to understand that. Humility protects us from the wiles of the devil. And I hope all of us this morning fall into the camp of Daniel, or at least Nebuchadnezzar after he recovers. Those are the three things we're going to look at. We're going to look at the humbled, the judged, and the delivered. So the humbled. Verse 4, chapter 4, it says, "I was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace." This is Nebuchadnezzar speaking. You know, prosperity is often the most spiritually dangerous season as believers. It's much more dangerous than being in great need or being in great trouble. Prosperity can often it clouds our vision. It blinds us for our need for God. If you think about it, for all that is in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Of those three things, pride is the most systemic of all of that. It's the most systemic. That pride of life, or the pride generally drives those other two vices. The pride of man is very destructive to the core. I mentioned this before. One of the first Bible studies the Lord ever gave me directly was about pride in my own life, the kind of pride that, you know, you have. I was at a Bible school in Oregon, and I remember clashing with a lot of different people out there. And I always thought, hey, it's them. It's them. And God pointed me to this one verse in Proverbs. It says, only by pride comes contention, but with the well-advised is wisdom. And I have noticed in my own life that I am much more thankful when I have needs in my life, when I understand that it's God that I need, it's God that supports, it's God that gives me everything that I need. You know, where things prosper, I'm not as thankful. When I'm very prosperous, I'm not as thankful. So Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 is beginning to forget the past lessons, that those three guys, or actually the four guys in the furnace, he's learning the lessons that it is God that rules. Now, I kind of like Nebuchadnezzar. For some reason, looking at the things that he goes through, I have a feeling we're going to see him in heaven. For some reason. I don't know. I can't predict who's going to heaven, who's not. But Nebuchadnezzar humbled himself before the Lord. And I like him. And in the back of my mind, I can see him in heaven. You know, God sends him a dream about a great, glorious... Have you guys read all four chapters? Or three chapters, right? All right, good. So you're ahead of me, right? You know what's going on with this dream. God sends him a dream, sees this great, glorious tree reach into heaven. It's suddenly cut down by a watcher. And that's in Daniel chapter 4, verse 10 through 14. And that word watcher, it only appears in the Bible in Daniel, and it just means an angelic being, some kind of angelic being. It actually, when it's in Aramaic, it's a sentinel or a holy one or a heavenly being, or one who watches. So it's an angel. All angels declared in the New Testament are messengers of God, that they're messengers of God. You got Gabriel being a messenger to Mary and Joseph. Gabriel's going to be in chapter 9, that we're going to see him back 600 years from the time of Jesus. So none of the wizards of Babylon can interpret it. Daniel again comes to the rescue. Babylon around this time, now this is really important to understand, it was an incredible kingdom. It would be incredible for us to see something like that, even though we've seen incredible things in our nation. The historians say that Babylon surpassed all other kingdoms of the known world at the time. The outer walls, when you go in the circumference of the outer walls, 56 miles in circumference, that's pretty good size. You're talking about a big city. Wide enough, well, put it this way, the walls alone were 80 feet thick, right? Think about that. We measure walls in footage. This is 80 feet. It's very thick. And they're 320 feet high. So amazing, glorious kingdom. One of the historians says, wide enough, he said, to allow a four-horse chariot to make a turn on the top of the wall. You guys have heard about the Hanging Gardens, right, of Babylon, how beautiful they were. That was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Nebuchadnezzar, you are that tree. That's what Daniel tells him. You are that tree. So a whole year passes. And again, I'll read this again, verse 29. At the end of those 12 months, now Daniel has announced, you are the tree. There's some other things in that, some of the vision or the dream. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon, and he speaks these words, "Is this not great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling of my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" It's actually the next verse. It says, while the words were still in the king's mouth, bam, he's humbled. For the next 7 years, it says seven times, but we suspect 7 years, he becomes mad. A madness enters his life. He becomes, they put him out, and his fingernails grow real long. His hair is all scraggly, and it says in the dew, or the he's a mess. He's a total mess for 7 years. Very interesting. There's on the walls of Babylon, and they uncovered a lot of the history. There is a gap of 7 years in their history that they never recorded. They never recorded it. And, you know, no king is going to, hey, we won this war, we won that. Hey, we lost that pretty miserably. He doesn't write those things down in those days. They only talk about the glorious things. But there is a gap of the history, 700 or 572 BC or something like that. I forget exactly the dates, but there's a gap. So for 7 years, he grew long fingernails. It's not 7 months. I mean, 7 months, my fingernails wouldn't be that long. You're talking about 7 years. He became like an animal. That's what happened. It turned into madness. But listen to verse 34. This is where Nebuchadnezzar shines. He says, at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him who lives forever. See, he forgot about that statue. Remember, he makes the all-gold statue because he thinks Babylon's going to exist forever. But each kingdom falls to, eventually, the kingdom of God. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. My understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generations. His confession, I finally came to my senses. I finally came to my senses. You know, oh to God that we would always come to our senses. All the time, that we would be in the right mind. Because otherwise, we're going to fall to the fate of Nebuchadnezzar's grandson that we're going to look at next in chapter 5. So we see this. He was humbled. He humbled himself before the Lord, and the Lord restored him. So that's what humility, judgment and humility, and then chastisement, and he comes to his senses. Chapter 5 is a little bit different. You know, it's a spiritual fact that how we deal with our spiritual pride or our pride is how God is going to deal with us. How we deal with it. All of us have pride. All of us. All of us have that desire in our heart to be more than what we are. And to be defensive, to blame others. All these different things that pride brings about. It's a spiritual fact, though. How you deal with it is how God deals with us. And it's important to understand that. Nebuchadnezzar, though he was chastised from God, he had a good outcome. He humbled himself, so God lifted him from that madness. And he came to his senses, and he set aside the delusions that he spoke out about him building the kingdom. It is God who raises up. It is God who puts down. You know, we vote in our elections, and we should vote, and we pray for good leaders. But it is God that raises up which president. It's God puts down whoever he wants to. So we got to remember that, too. And that's why I think it's important, whether you like the person in office or not, you pray for him, because God has set him up in such a way. But Nebuchadnezzar comes to his senses. He set aside that his delusions. It is God who rules from the heavens. Now, a little side note, the world looks like it's out of control. Wouldn't you agree? It looks like it's out of control. There's so many things going on. God's point of view, it's never out of control. It's never out of control. And, you know, you need to be able to look at that in your own life. We see our lives in chaos or trials or tribulation, and you think, it's just, where is God? God is still there. And your life is never out of control in the hands of God. It's never out of control. You might think it is. You might perceive that it is, but it's never out of control, because God is in control of all things. So it's good to remember that in your own life. So this is 539 BC. This is Belshazzar. He's the grandson of King Nebuchadnezzar. His father is off in another city doing some other stuff. It's actually Belshazzar who is ruling in Babylon at the time. Now, this morning in chapter 5, it's the end of the Babylonian Empire. You had the head of gold, right? Now comes in the Mede-Persian Empire. So it's the end of it. In chapter 5, it's the end of the Babylonian Empire. This Belshazzar, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, will be killed, and the Mede-Persian Empire will begin their reign, and they will capture Babylon. Remember, the arms, the Mede, the Persians. That's why you had the arms in that particular statue that we looked at last week. So it's the arms from chapter 2. So let me give you a real short story on it. This is a story about a king who had knowledge of what God did in the past with the kingdom of Babylon, with his grandfather, how he humbled them, but continued in a prideful way to the point of mocking God. That's Belshazzar. So look at verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine at the presence of the household, or the thousand. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and the silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken, that's his grandfather, had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So these were the temple instruments. They would use this for holy service in the temple the temple back in Jerusalem is destroyed right now. So Nebuchadnezzar took all of these devices, the cups, the different things that they would use in the temple for the temple worship. And he decides that he's going to... Now, remember, this Belshazzar knows about the history of his grandfather. He knows about all the different things that went on, and yet he's in this, he's really mocking God. I would think, well, what if he went and took the devices from the Syrians or the Moabites or anything like that? But there's a spiritual component here where he begins to mock God. That term, while he tasted the wine, means that he was intoxicated. He was drunk. While he is drinking and drunk, this Belshazzar gives a command to bring the gold and the silver vessels of the temple that were from Jerusalem. And they begin to drink from the vessels of the temple of the Lord that they captured in Jerusalem. So this is arrogance. It's irreverence, but in particular, it's aimed toward the God of Israel. Now, I forgot to mention this, but while they're doing this, outside that wall of Babylon, you've got thousands and thousands of troops from the Mede-Persian Empire. They just can't get in. They just can't get in. The walls are so thick, they're so tall, it's difficult. But they're at this point, while he's drinking from the vessels of the temple, they're surrounding the city. They're surrounding the city. Now, they knew they were surrounding the city, but yet they continued to in their pride, in their arrogance, to drink from those vessels. They thought they were really safe. Hey, we got 350-foot walls. They're 80-foot thick. How are they going to get in? They've got water supply because the Euphrates River runs right through the city. It's their water supply, their sewage, all of that. So water supply, no problem. It is said that they probably had about 20 years of food inside the city at that point. So they were going to wait it out. A normal siege back then could last months and months and months, maybe even years. But they were all set up. They were supplied with everything. Now, this is the Babylonians' perspective, right? They're drunk. They're mocking God. Their arrogance. Hey, how are they going to even get into the city? So the mockery continues. And look at verse 5. It says, in that very same hour that they brought out those vessels to drink in it, Belshazzar sees what appears to be a man's hand who begins to write something on the wall. Now, I don't think anything would sober me up quick to see some vision that I don't know if other people saw that, okay? Other people saw it. I don't think anything would sober you up quicker than a vision from God. And it says in verse 6, it says, his knees smote one against one another so that the joints of his loins were loosed. Now, I need to be really careful about this because some commentators believe that that statement refers to the king. And to be very delicate, he soiled himself because of the fear. That's what it appears. Belshazzar, you have been weighed in the balance of God, and you can read all of this if you've read all of it. You've been weighed in the balance of God, and you've been found wanting. And you've heard that expression. You've heard the writing on the wall. That's where we get it from this particular book. So that very night, Babylon falls. It's in verse 30. Exactly, now listen to this, and I'm going to give you a little homework assignment because this is important. I'm only going to read one of these verses, but Isaiah chapter 45, verses 1 through 5. If you want to mark that down for your notes and to look at that later. That very night, Babylon falls. Exactly as Isaiah prophesied 150 years before this ever happened. And that's in Isaiah, like I said, 45, verses 1 through 5. And I want to read and I'll explain it a little bit better. I'm going to read the first verse in Isaiah. It says, thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus. Cyrus is not even born yet. He's 150 years in the hole when you think about that. Hasn't even been born. He's going to be born 150 years. We know that Cyrus is one of the great kings of the Medo-Persian Empire. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, I will loose the loins of king, right? That's exactly what happened. And then he says this, to open before him the two levied gates, and the gates shall not be shut. So you got the Mede-Persian army on the outside, surrounded the city. You've got Belshazzar in there drinking with all his arrogant people, right? All the Babylonian officials. So the Mede-Persian army did something really interesting. They rerouted the Euphrates River. Because the Euphrates River went right to the city, right? They rerouted it, and they found two open gates that they walked in the city without any fight at all. They walked into Babylon through that, because the river ran through, the levee gates were under the river, but when they rerouted it, they found, and this is God predicting this 150 years before, "Thus saith the Lord to the anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, I will loose the loin of kings and to open before him the two levied gates, and the gates shall not be shut." It is said that they, when they walked into the city, a couple of things happened. One of the things is that Daniel, this is kind of Jewish history, approached Cyrus with the prophecy in Isaiah. The second thing, though, is that they, for a few days, didn't even know that they were captured. It was such a big city. They ended up killing Belshazzar that night, I'm sure others. So here's the difference. The difference between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar is that Belshazzar never humbled himself. He never humbled himself. Do you guys remember this words of Jesus in the gospel? It's in Luke, it's in Matthew. He says, whoever falls on the stone will be broken. Okay? We fall on the stone. That's Jesus Christ. We fall on him. But on whomever it falls, it will grind them to powder. It will grind them to powder. And then what that means is that if we humble ourselves before the Lord, he will lift us up. He will lift us up. If we refuse that, the humbled will be lifted. The pride will be destroyed. That's basically, James talks about that. So whoever falls on the stone will be broken, but whomever it falls, it will grind into powder. So we have the humbled of Nebuchadnezzar, we have the judged of his grandson, Belshazzar, and now we talk about Daniel. Verse 1 of chapter 6, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps, to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one of them, and the satraps might give account to them, so the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." So Babylon has fallen. The Mede-Persian Empire rises. Daniel's probably in his late 80s. He's still distinguished because of that verse 3. An excellent spirit was in him. Now, you have jealousy arise. You have Darius is wanting to set the whole kingdom in Daniel's hands. You got this jealousy arising because of all the other people. Then you have a conspiracy that forms. And they cannot find any fault in Daniel. They cannot find any fault in Daniel. They could find no charge or fault because in verse 4 it says he was faithful. So what they do is they attack his faith. They convince Darius to sign a decree forbidding prayer or worship except toward him. That's in verse 7 through 9. Daniel knows that the decree is signed. He knows it's signed. He knows the lions are waiting. But the scripture says he knelt down three times that day as was his custom since early days. That's in verse 10. I love the fact that Daniel has been doing this consistently from his youth. You know, we saw at the very beginning a young 12, 13, or 14-year-old boy, and now we see a man into his 80s, but he's been consistent all of these years. God has been faithful to Daniel. But I love the fact that he's been doing this forever. He did not change his devotion because the world changed the law. That's so important to understand that. We can't conform to those laws that are against the Lord. We should obey all things that the law speaks about. But there's times to resist it, and this time Daniel is resisting it. So I don't know if you guys know it, but we have an enemy. And that enemy both sets traps and then springs traps on us, just like they're doing to Daniel. And the reason for it is to stop or impede our spiritual progress. The traps that he sets up, and I've walked into some of those traps in my life, and boy, I think I ran out a little faster than I walked in, but it happens. The devil sets up those traps, and then he springs it on us. And the reason is to stop us dead. The reason, real reason, is to stop us completely, to stop us from seeking the Lord. And it's a sad thing because you see a lot of people when they first come to Christ, all the heavy trials hit them at all at once, and then pretty soon they're turning back. But the devil's purpose is to destroy, kill and destroy. That's what Jesus said. So Daniel is such a great example of character. His reputation has spread all around. His trustworthiness, his faithfulness. But I'll tell you, he's also a really great illustration to us 2,500 years later. Because how to deal with the adversary, how to deal with it. You know, there's three types of adversaries that we encounter in our life. Is one is self-imposed. We make mistakes. We make mistakes all the time. There's sometimes God imposed what he allows in our life, and then the enemy imposes it on us. And those three things are true, the attacks of the enemy. And we really do have a real enemy, and Daniel had real enemies back then. And the devil is there to take us down, is to destroy our marriages, to turn our children toward the world. And this Daniel had real enemies. So he's arrested in verse 11 to 13. Then you see in verse 18 that actually Darius is very concerned about this. He knew Daniel. He knew his character. Now the king went into his palace and spent the night fasting. No musicians were brought before him, and he slept, and his sleep went from him. So the Mede-Persian Empire, they had a law that if the king signed it, it's like we have laws now that govern our with Congress and whatever. They can repeal the laws. The Mede-Persian Empire, not so. Once the king signed it, there was nothing you could do. Even the king couldn't take that back. He couldn't take it back. It was just the way the Mede-Persian Empire was set up. So Darius knew that he was duped and had a real concern for Daniel. Then verse 19, then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angels and shut the lions' mouths, so they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him And also, O King, I have done no wrong before you. So I love the fact that when Daniel prayed, he left the windows open. I don't know if they had curtains or whatever, but he left in full view that people would, Lord, give us that boldness, especially today. If you read the chapter, you know his accusers were eventually fed to the lions. It says that when Darius pulled Daniel out of the lion's den, and they rounded up all his accusers and they threw them in the lion's den. Now I want to read the conclusion of the matter with Darius. You have Darius, you've got this Mede-Persian Empire, you've got Cyrus, you got Darius. But this is Darius. King Darius, he says this in verse 25. To all people, nations, and language that dwell on the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and into the reign of Cyrus the Persian. My God sent an angel and shut the lion's mouth. He's lifted out without injury. And, you know, Daniel's story teaches us that faithfulness is just long obedience to God. Just being long obedience. Courage is doing the right thing even when the consequences are certain. You know, the enemy sets traps. You can see that in Psalm 64. God protects his own. You can see that in Isaiah 54. And God vindicates the faithful. Vindicates the faithful. Sometimes you see injustice and you have to wait on the Lord for him to vindicate it. So we've been talking about pride, or the humbled, the judged, and the delivered. You know, Nebuchadnezzar shows us pride. Belshazzar shows us rebellion. Daniel shows us faithfulness. So those three men, three outcomes. The pride brings downfall, humility brings restoration, and faithfulness brings vindication. And the one truth I started off with, I want to close with: the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Amen? You guys want to stand? Worship.